Hi, everyone. It's Bill Black, the Exit Coach from the Exit Coach Radio Show. You know, one of the biggest questions I get on the show is, what exactly goes into a business exit plan, and when should I start creating mine? Well, I always tell people that the best time to start was 5 years ago, but the next best time is now, because you never know when you might need it. So we put together a free report that describes what an exit plan is and what you should know. You can get it free by texting exit plan with no spaces to 44222. That's exit plan to 44222. Again, text exit plan to 44222.
Welcome to the Exit Coach Radio Show, the show for baby boomer business owners who are looking for cutting-edge information as they plan their 3 to 10 year business succession and exit. Every week, we interview top professional advisors for their best tips, strategies, and precautions so you can be well-planned. And now, here's your host, the Exit Coach, Bill Black.
Well, hey, everyone. Thanks so much for joining me today. Always a pleasure. Today's guest is Brian Johnson, and Brian is the founder and owner of Main & Johnson, a Charlotte, North Carolina-based business consulting and coaching company that's aimed at seeing small to medium businesses thrive, not just survive. Brian's a persuasive and adaptable top performer who's skilled in establishing, managing, and mentoring key executives and business owners, as well as individual contributors in a business. He has a passion for changing the cultural fabric of people leadership, marketing, and sales in companies by empowering teams to exceed goals. So grab a pen and a pad of paper and get ready to take some notes as I introduce Brian Johnson. Brian, welcome to the show, and thanks so much for joining me today.
Hey, Bill, I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
It is my pleasure, Brian. One of the things we like to do before we get into the meat of the interview is give our listeners a sense of who you are. So tell us a little bit more about you and your background and how you help folks.
Yeah, absolutely. I appreciate it. And a Midwest guy, kind of Ohio my whole life, spent 20-some years in the Fortune 500 world, had a really unique opportunity to travel the world, which is more and more common these days, but also in that got to work in a lot of different positions within the corporate structure and different, I guess, disciplines within the organization. Got relocated down to Charlotte, still working in that space, and had an opportunity to stay put and start something on my own and really kind of really assess, you know, where did I want to be? Did I want to be back in, you know, as a VP of sales or doing something a little bit more locally based at the beginning and then broadening that? And so started my own company, working with first small businesses to kind of establish sort of a revenue stream on just helping them work to grow. But what I realized is a lot of the businesses that were out there very much needed to look not just at how do I grow, but how does this whole process look, and started getting into a little bit more of the consulting and advising in that realm. So, you know, had my company now for a little over 3 years, again, Charlotte-based, but as we all found out kind of during the COVID situation, a lot of stuff can be done centrally located, but virtually, and got an opportunity during that time to really expand out beyond kind of the North Carolina borders. So, but that's sort of it in a nutshell, Bill.
Sorry, I was muted. That's great. Brian, what were some of the biggest differences you saw from working in a big corporation to what you're seeing, what I call the chief everything officers of a small business, the CEOs, to what you're seeing them do? What are some of the biggest ahas that you had when you looked at, okay, I came from a big corporate world, but boy, these people are really, their job description is everything.
Yeah, actually, and to be honest, I may steal that. The chief everything officers pretty much clicks right on there, but you're right. And I think the big thing is, it's got to really come down to just resources. I mean, in the end, you know, when you own your own business, you're CEO of it, which, you know, is more than just kind of oversight and guidance generally. A lot of times it comes down to, I've got a great plan, I've got an idea, but man, it's just really tough sometimes to peel back and have the resources that, you know, I became accustomed to getting out there. You know, it was a quick, stark reality when, you know, you sit down with somebody and you say, this is what you should do. And they're like, well, I know that, but how do I make that work? And that was one of the things that we quickly found a niche with, is especially in that exit planning process, is really it's not just, you know, the steps to take, but actually working with them on the execution in those phases. So resources was probably that eye-opening thing that, you know, you knew it, but you didn't really know it until you saw it.
Yeah, that's a big one. You know, one of the big things that make a business unattractive to a potential buyer is when the owner is you know, doing everything and they haven't either had the resources to delegate properly, or they're gonna leave, and now all that stuff's not gonna get done. How do you, or what ways do you identify businesses to understand their current situation and when they should be planning for their exit?
Yeah, there's always the desire to have a magic number, and of course you've got to take a look at, you know, outside environment. I'm sure anybody that was thinking 3 years ago, hey, I might want to get out of this thing in 3 to 5 years, and then the pandemic hits, and they might have said, like, scratch that. I'm thinking, you know, right now. So timing has something to do with it. But I think when you look inside the company, a lot comes down to how are they operating today? Where might some low-hanging fruit be in just in terms of, you know, making it more efficient? I mean, in the end, when you're buying somebody's business, you want it to run. And I mean, you really hope it just takes off right away without a lot of your hard sweat, you know, blood and tears going into it. But at the same time, when you're looking to sell, like, how do you get to that point where I've got something so attractive that people want to overinvest in it to get it? And we usually kind of assess first, you know, where are you? What's the current things you do well? You know, where are the areas of opportunity? And what are the capabilities? Because in a lot of cases, like you mentioned, it's, you know, I know I need something to be done. I need to delegate more. I need this to be more hands-off and attractive before I sell. But what if I don't even have that capability within the organization? So a lot of times that planning is greater. As you mentioned, you know, the best time to have planned this out was 5 years ago. The next best time is today. And a lot of that really comes from the same standpoint of, there are things you may need to go do and invest in your business to make it more attractive to sell. And so it's not usually a rush to get rid of things. It might be, how do I add before I start, you know, trying to subtract?
Yeah, and of course, you know, we have gone through these challenging times that were totally unexpected. Heck, we don't know what's ahead, but, you know, a lot of these owners that we're talking to, you and I, that they've been through recessions before. They went through 2008, 2009, 10, 11, and they know that, you know, hey, there's a good time to sell, and there's a not so good time to sell, but I better be ready for anything. So now's the time to start planning to get ready. One of the things we talk about is, you know, a lot of owners find out their value is a lot lower than they thought, and they need to implement some growth strategies. And I know one of the things that you talk about is growth strategies in challenging times. What can you share with us on that topic?
Yeah, and I would say your audience probably has a really good grasp of this to an extent as well, which is, you know, a lot of the businesses that you see are out there right now. I mean, not all of them are out there for 30, 40 years, right? So some of them are 10 years and younger, even having gone through the COVID pandemic, which, you know, when you look back from a high level, that's a blip in the map in terms of just kind of the cycle that we go through. But in a lot of cases, businesses that are out there now are growing, but are they really growing, or are they just participating in a growing market? I mean, if the economy keeps improving year over year and you're out there and available, you're going to grow. And we always kind of say, like, if your pie is getting bigger, your slice should get bigger. And then the question becomes, well, if you're kind of navigating through maybe a period of not so, I guess, prolific economic conditions, then you get into that point of, how are you growing your business if it's not in your control? Meaning people aren't waving money at you trying to spend it. What happens when you have to go hunt for it? And the thought is, if you keep the same pie example, how do you get your slice bigger even if the pie's not getting bigger? Well, you have to have strategies on taking away chunks of somebody else's slice. And, you know, if you keep going down that road, if that becomes a challenge, or maybe you've got a strategy there, great, let's grow that one. What happens if you've got to do something to entice more people to want to be in your pie, not your competitors, but make your pie bigger, not because it's growing, but because you're adding to it? You know, and that's kind of what we look at as more transformational strategy, which is, I may create more demand for what it is I do, even though that demand may buy from my competition. I've just created a bigger market overall. And when you know, companies are working to do that, they may create a more attractive space. I mean, clearly, if you're going to buy, you want to buy in a healthy market, regardless of the company you're buying in. So if that market keeps growing, the opportunity is always there to go take it or grow with it. And then some other things we look at is another great way to differentiate your business is what little adjacencies might I add to it that maybe the next new owner would come in and say, wow, you kind of, that's a little, a bud, a seedling here, but that's got some potential. We really like how this is laid out. And so you give yourselves the best option. It's kind of like putting a patio on the, you know, putting a deck on the back of the house. Yeah, yeah, they may love it because they want it. You may never really use it, but it's there and it gives them the potential to really enjoy it when they buy your house.
Yeah, that's a good analogy. I just got back from fly fishing up in Montana, and you know, the guide was saying, you know, it's not what I put on the end of the line, it's what I don't put on the end of the line. When in certain times of day, we want to attract fish, you know. So same thing with buyers. You really need to understand what they're looking for. And you have something called the airline analogy for business. What's that?
Yeah, so one of the things we do, and we work beyond just exit planning, and that's just kind of a function of how our business works, but one of the things we utilize as a method to try to, you know, simplify and have a conversation with anyone without knowing the ins and outs of their industry around where they are in kind of the business cycle, the business life cycle. And so I used to live my life, you know, 30,000 feet and above, and, you know, it kind of always resonated with me, and I thought, well, if I can articulate it, go with it. And it's basically, if you broke down kind of the business life cycle into four phases, and you might move in and out of it in business, an airline follows a very similar pattern. So if you've got takeoff, for example, your business startup phase, you know, if you're on a plane, it's seat back in the upright lock position, tray table stowed, bags underneath the seat in front of you, you know, blah, blah, blah. That's to earn the right to take off. You know, that gets you out on the tarmac, gets you out on the runway, and then somebody has to say you're clear to take off. Same thing in business when you're starting out. You've got a checklist of things you've got to do, business plan, funding, you know, do I even know where I'm headed in this business just to get started, just to be legitimate. You know, then the second phase is sort of the ascension phase on a plane. How the heck do I get to 30,000 feet, it's seemingly as fast as possible without being a rocket going vertical? And that's really, everybody stays in their seat on the plane. Nobody moves around. Nobody's using the bathroom. Everybody is sort of all positioned for just one thing, and that's 30,000 feet. Same thing in business. At that point, I'm building my sustainable business, but I'm kind of really surviving right now. Like, I need my top line to be big enough to pay my bills and stuff like that, get to the point where I can pay myself, all of that. Everybody's 30,000 feet is different, but you know when you meet somebody in that mode because they're basically willing to say yes just about to any sort of income and revenue as they're growing and stuff. We've all been there.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Then you get to that cruising out. Probably the majority of time most businesses exist, and that's, you know, where the seatbelts come off. You can get up and walk around. You know, airlines come out, and they this is where they make their loyalty. They serve the drinks, the cookies. One has better coffee than another. You know, this is where in business, you know, you're working on your profitability and efficiencies. You know, how do I be more effective? How do I put in the right customer strategy, employee retention strategies, things like that. But that part of the journey is I'm not so worried about surviving. I may grow. I may adjust for turbulence, things like that. But I'm in that mode where I'm relevant, and now how do I stay relevant? How do I stay at 30,000 feet or whatever that level is? And then eventually descension, which is probably a little bit more what we're talking about. And that's, hey, I'm starting that initial descent. If you notice on a plane, it takes you 10 minutes to get to 30,000 feet. It takes you an hour to get to the ground once you start descending. So it's natural that that process should be a little bit longer and well thought out. So it's nice and smooth when you land. And we tell people we'll help you get to the point that you can sell, get to the point if you need to hand it off to somebody in your family that will help make sure that they're ready to go and trained up. But really build that out so that you do have that nice soft landing. So those are the four phases. We kind of use that analogy to identify where businesses are at so that we approach them in the right way.
I love that analogy. When you think about it, everybody's a little bit more tense on the takeoff and the landing, right? Things are a little bit more urgent. People, you know, if people are if they're folding their hands and praying, it's probably your takeoff and landing, not at the middle. So I really like that
You're
analogy.
Absolutely
it's
right.
That's, it, It's clear why you're successful at what you do, the way you describe things. I like that. So tell us a little bit about more. One of the things that you sent me earlier was business owners really need to get out of their own way in business. And I get what you mean, but maybe elaborate on that for the audience a little bit.
This is especially prevalent when you're looking to plan that exit. And a lot of it is I've spent my whole, you know, life doing this, or to whatever extent you've invested in it, you're waiting to capitalize on that investment. And a lot of times it's difficult to look at that situation and say, like, hey, I've been doing this for a while. All of a sudden, I've got to build a model that delegates. And when I say get out of your own way, you're clearly successful for a reason. Nobody goes to sell something that's not worth anything. So you've done a great job, but sometimes you're not the best person to be doing everything that needs to happen in order to get the most value out of that business. And that's where that delegation that you mentioned kind of really comes into play. And we try to make sure that when we put together those plans, and especially around the ease of execution, that it's very clear, you know, where you're going to be useful and what's the best use of that time resource that only you have versus where can we delegate, because clearly in the end, that system that runs without the previous owner is always one that's a little bit more attractive.
Right, right. Yeah, that makes sense. And, you know, that is a big challenge for a lot of owners, as we said earlier, is they're used to doing things their way, but nobody else might know how to do that, you know, and so they really need to take care to document and create their SOPs and all that kind of stuff, standard operating procedures. Hey, you have a couple tips for how to effective ways to increase your price in your business. Could you share that with our listeners?
Yeah, and I mean, a lot of times when somebody's buying a business, they're really in truth buying, you know, the functionality, but also the book of business. So they're looking at how sustainable is the business that I'm inheriting as I go in. Aside from, you know, having things locked up to be there and ready to go, one of the things you always need to be looking at in your business is, you know, yes, my customers are important. Absolutely. There's no doubt about that. But not all customers are created equally. And in a lot of cases, people have a fear over price simply because of the implications they believe it will have, when 90% of the time, more people are buying on some value you're providing, not the actual price. That doesn't even account into switching costs and stuff like that. But when we look at that, there's a lot of cause for assessing our customer base and being able to segment them out into categorizations that say, hey, if I've got an A customer because of these things, I'm going to do this with my A customers. You know, if they happen to be an F or a D customer, what am I doing to either move them up or move them out? I always tell people, the best gift you can give your competition is your worst customers.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's a good point. Really good point. A ton of great information so far, Brian. You really have nailed a lot of these things perfectly. How do you best engage with businesses to get them to the exit they seek?
Yeah, we go through a process where we sit down and kind of really understand what that success looks like to them. You know, we also interject things to consider. Like you mentioned, timing is sometimes everything. There's a good time to buy, a good time to sell, and that gets factored in. But really, what's that desired state look like, and how does that look along the way? I mean, a lot of people visualize the end and where they're at, but there's steps in there. Like, it's not an instant, like, okay, I'm delegating tomorrow, and that's it, and that's the end of it. So we kind of work with them to kind of build a timeline based on the input that they've got and where they see their ability to kind of take those steps and phases to get from here to there. And that's totally different for every business. So we don't want to come in and say, here's what you got to do. We want to listen and really understand and say, we're going to work with you to build this plan out so that it's something you're going to want to embrace and run with to get what you're looking for.
Yeah, good point. Because some people might want to, you know, we always tell people, yeah, it's the three T's, right? It's your timing. It's your target. Who do you want to be the future owner? And the treasure. What do you want to get out of this thing? What do you need to get out of this thing, and what's it worth? There's a lot to it. There's a lot to this. I really like the conversation that we've had today. Tell us how our listeners can best get in touch with you, and maybe, you know, what they might find at your website that would help them decide whether to give you a call or not.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, our website, www.businessconsultingcharlotte.com, that's a great place to just see the different ways that we interact with businesses. We found businesses that go in with an exit plan in mind and they come out thinking, I want to run this for a while longer. That's great. We can help there too. But that'll give you an idea of the services that we offer. You can also find me on LinkedIn, find us on LinkedIn. I think it's Brian Johnson 28120, if that's how they work. The great ways to do it. We love meeting new business owners. We learn every time we talk with them. And if we're a good fit for somebody, we're happy to engage and help them get to that, descension and landing that they're looking for.
Yeah, and I'm looking at your website. It talks about one-to-one coaching, seminars, workshops, mastermind groups. You all really help to educate people how, you know, what maybe the task at hand is going to look like to help them get to know you and decide whether, you know, they want to get involved or not. And that's really what consumers are looking for, and that's what our listeners are looking for. So I really want to thank you once again, Brian Johnson, for coming on and really offering just some great, clear tips. We learned a lot from you today, and I really want to thank you on behalf of our listeners for sharing all of your information with us.
Much appreciated, Bill. Thank you.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back after this, so please stay with us.
And now the Exit Coach Radio Show proudly presents the All-Star Review, a compilation of one-minute highlights from past guests. Hear more one-minute highlights and full interviews from these guests at ExitCoachRadio.com.
When your business value is wrapped up in your client list, what's the most important thing you can do to drive the value of your business? We asked expert Stacy McKibben.
If you don't have really strong, you know, client relation management tools, CRMs, as they're lovingly referred to, if you don't have tools like that in your business, it's going to be very difficult to transition it over. As a matter of fact, your next buyer is going to use that as a reason to drive down your sale price. Absolutely, one of the biggest areas of opportunity that we see in professional services businesses are going back to your existing and previous clients. Oftentimes, we just forget that they don't necessarily know the full breadth of services that we provide and how they can use us or even refer us to their friends and family. So that is a big win in most businesses, is just starting there. And it's very difficult to do if you don't have a good system in place with which to do it.
One of the most common ways a business is sold is through something called an earnout. And we asked for information and an example from business broker Chris Bond.
What buyers want to have happen is they want a seller to prove the actual value of the business by having them be patient and waiting for a piece of the payout. So in other words, once the transition period has happened, say 6, 12, 18, or 24 months, the buyer will make additional payments with the comfort that, okay, it is what you said it is. Had a very creative deal earlier this year where down payment was made for about 80% of the deal. A bank stepped in for a percentage of the deal. The seller actually financed another small percentage of the deal. And the earnout comes in years 3, 4, and 5. So everybody's pulling in the same direction, making sure the first 2 years go very smoothly.
What are some of the challenges for leaders in this knowledge-based economy? Here's CEO Coach Bill Anton.
The person that has the most influence over the entire organization is the person that leads the organization. And transforming that person exponentially influences change. My training as a psychologist, my understanding about the kinds of organizations that are going to be successful in the future are going to be organizations that realize that knowledge is their product and that knowledge can only be created by enrollment, not by compliance. And so the task of the leader of the future is to transform the people that work in the organization so that they want to give their best and so that they're willing to offer ideas and perspectives that create knowledge and innovation for the organization.
Medical insurance is a big part of your budget. How do you contain those costs? We ask benefits expert Rhett Bray.
We'll talk about wellness is how we can start to communicate the importance of the wellness and that we give the people and the employees the opportunities to do things that will help them to become healthier. We start to educate them on the importance of annual physicals. We start to educate them on preventative care. Women do this quite well. Men have a tendency to wait till body parts don't work and then they go, which can be late. And it's interesting, we take better care of our car. We change the oil. We see the lamp light comes on, and for a lot of us, we don't do the maintenance that we should do on a regular basis. That will identify a lot of issues that people have that now you can start to address either through medication, through exercise or diet. There are just a few key areas that you can identify that will drive these higher costs.
Okay, so we've heard the term before, treat your business like an investment. It'll be a lot easier to sell down the road. What exactly does that mean? We asked an expert, Don Berzin.
Many of us in the field encourage owners to look at their business as an investment. Some owners understand that concept, but many do not. I mean, for a number of them, they see their business as either a job, a cash machine, a passion, or an extension of who they are. And the term investment sounds a little too removed for them to relate to. And we also let it be known that a business is actually easier to sell when it has a passive ownership, I mean, an owner who is not personally critical to maintaining future cash flows. But let's face it, I mean, one of the last terms that ever come to mind when we think about most entrepreneurs is passive. You know, these people are doers. They make things happen. And sitting on the sidelines is not something that many of them want to do at any stage of their career.
At ExitCoachRadio.com, we're interviewing over 100 top advisors to get you one-minute tips, ideas, and precautions so you can be well-planned. We upload new content daily at 6 a.m. and 1 p.m. ExitCoachRadio.com. Come listen for a minute.
Why would you have a revocable living trust instead of a will? Here's attorney Matt Amaro.
One of the main reasons that you would consider doing a revocable trust versus just having a will is avoiding what we would call a probate process, which is a court proceeding to distribute a family estate, which can be very expensive and legal fees, court fees, and just involves a lot of court involvement that can be pretty painful. So by using a trust, you can get out of that. Now, if your assets aren't high enough, that's one way you may be able to avoid probate without a trust. And the other way is you may have assets that are able to pass to beneficiaries outside of a trust and outside of probate, even if you don't have a trust. But when you have real property, you usually won't be able to avail yourself of those two exceptions to staying out of probate.
How do most people decide it's time to start exit planning, and what's on their mind when they do? Here's Jim Immel.
Long term is really interesting. I use the analogy of the light switch. Sometimes these business owners don't think about it, and then all of a sudden they wake up one day and they just want to turn the light switch off, and they go from being passionate 100% into the game, and then all of a sudden something starts feeling heavy. Maybe it's a personal situation that's happened, but they literally turn the light switch off. Most of the people that you and I work with, it's more like a dimmer switch. They just don't do it that quick. They do it over time. But what really a lot of them are thinking about is, how do I transition myself out of the leadership position, provide other people opportunity to get into that leadership position, so the business is being prepared to transition from a position of strength and not weakness.
People are nervous about stocks and bonds these days. What's the outlook for income real estate? We asked real estate expert Scott Tamkin.
I'm a firm believer that income property will grow wealth over time. And there are parts of Los Angeles where income property is still affordable. The west side of LA doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but there are parts of LA where there are still opportunities. And I firmly believe that, particularly in some of the outlying areas, the gentrification will continue and people will want to rent in those areas, particularly as public transportation expands. People have some extra money. They're looking to invest in income property. I would say good strategy might be to join up with others who are doing the same. There are some crowdfunding sites that offer some opportunities to do that, but I would be careful just jumping in and talk to an expert in the multifamily business. I think over time it will prove to be lucrative.
Protecting your assets is important, but when you do it is even more important. Here's attorney Harry Barth.
A very important component to understand is that, as with all business deals, asset protection being just one of them, to be able to settle a proposed claim within reasonable limits. It's very, very difficult to do that if you are in jeopardy of losing your home, losing your business, and losing your life savings. So I think that it's important that asset protection is granular. We look at the various components. We take into consideration all of the goals and objectives of our particular clients. And there's not one size fits all. Every situation is different. Every background is different. Every family makeup is different. Every business transaction is different.
What's the best way to use Twitter and other social media? We asked expert Tim Templeton.
I just had a friend ask me today, I don't really get Twitter. What is the value? And I said, you know, it's two things. It's self-promotion, or business promotion in this case, and it's research. So if you want people to know who you are and what you're doing, and you create content, you create blog content, you want people to see it, one of the best ways to get it out in front of people is to send out an announcement using Twitter. Likewise, if you're trying to find people in your ecosystem, your business, the analysts, the resellers, the potential partners, you can find them by their activity on Twitter. You can interact with them, you can follow them, you can retweet things that they're sending, and you can create a relationship that way, which is a lot easier than it used to be.
And now the Exit Coach Radio Show proudly presents the All-Star Review, a compilation of one-minute highlights from past guests. Hear more one-minute highlights and full interviews from these guests at ExitCoachRadio.com.
Of all the things that can happen on the way to the sale of your business, having a deal fall apart because of sloppy financials is probably the worst. Here's expert Addison Adams.
In the sale of a company, you are in a very cooperative process with the other side. If you're the seller of the business and the buyer is coming in and evaluating whether to buy your business, there needs to be a high level of trust there. A trust that you are not only being open and honest about your business and what you know about it, but also credibility that you know what you're talking about. And that when you hand over your financial statements, for example, they're clean, they're correct, they're complete, and they're not misleading. Preferably they're audited, and not only currently audited, but going back several years. And this is so that there is a confidence that comes in from the point of view of the buyer.
You're the trustee of your company's 401k or profit sharing plan. You have certain responsibilities. What can happen when things go wrong? We ask Buck Blanton.
We have a responsibility when we run qualified plans as a business owner, or in that world we call it a plan sponsor. That person has a responsibility of due care and due loyalty to the participant. And sometimes we forget that when we run plans and we do other things. But as you said, those breaches can become kind of onerous. The 2013 audit year, there were 3,566 audits performed by the Department of Labor, and more than $2.7 billion with a B dollars in fines and penalties were levied. All of those things can be done and levied against corporate officers personally. It's not your corporate seat that might get sued or levied. It's going to be you personally.
What are some of the biggest challenges facing family businesses in their management transition? We asked Transition Consulting Group's David and Paul Karofsky for their thoughts regarding this topic.
As the baby boomers are coming of age and getting a little bit older, as the next generation is starting to get a little bit older and come into that leadership position, this transfer of not only monetary wealth, but you're talking about the businesses, the assets, whatever it might be, there needs to be a plan to transfer that seamlessly. To my dad's point, the more planning you do and you talk about it as to what that transition of ownership looks like, what is that transition of leadership, those two are not the same. They can be similar in tie, but they can be mutually exclusive as well. But until you really have a plan as to how you transfer that business from one generation to the next, it's very difficult to do it.
When a parent passes away, sometimes dealing with mom or dad's effects can be challenging. Here's senior real estate expert Allison Whitaker.
There's different levels of sorting through things. And so we work with organizers and professional inventory people, estate sale planners. And basically, they come in and they will help you sort, is this a donation pile? Is this a for sale pile? Are these items things that we need to send off to our auction house in London to get appraised and actually auction off? There's different auction houses as well, not just Sotheby's. If it's sports memorabilia, you know, that we would recommend using. There's also that element of, is it a good time to sell the house when it comes to taxes? Taxes are a whole nother conversation, and a lot of times people think, well, the market's up, we should just sell the house, but there could be some tax ramifications depending upon the way the estate has been set up, that maybe it's better to rent it out for a couple years.
How would an attorney specializing in professionals handle a case differently? We asked Miranda McCroskey.
A young man came to me with an allegation of a hit and run, and he was looking at jail time. Going to jail was going to be a big problem for a lot of reasons. So I provided the district attorney with all the mitigating factors, all the factors that they could consider in determining his sentence. And I stressed to the DA the consequences of the criminal conviction on this young man. And the benefit is he was able to do a diversion program, which means avoiding the conviction entirely. The less obvious benefit was that he avoided the criminal conviction that would have affected his path because he wanted to be a physical therapist. From the application process to the physical therapy board through the renewals that each board has, he would have had to bring that conviction up year after year and discuss that. And so he got to avoid all of that.
At ExitCoachRadio.com, we're interviewing over 100 top advisors to get you one-minute tips, ideas, and precautions so you can be well-planned. We upload new content daily at 6 a.m. and 1 p.m. ExitCoachRadio.com. Come listen for a minute.
With all the social media platforms to choose from, why has YouTube become so popular? We asked Joan Pounds.
The younger generations do a lot more visually, so a lot of times your YouTube videos and things like that are better ways to reach out to them. I found out through my son, actually, who's a teenager, that YouTube is the second largest search engine in the world. And I never even thought about going to YouTube to find out how to do something. And the beauty about YouTube is we can create our own videos right now from our phones and upload them to YouTube. And the neat thing about that is you're creating your own celebrity during that time. People buy from those they know, like, and trust. And that's one way for people to reach out, begin to know you and to like you and to trust you.
Family businesses can be very challenging sometimes. Here's Roseanne Levy from the Roark Group.
What I tell people is think about your family and think about working with them. We address many issues of families who work together and really help them resolve them. What are they dealing with? What are their major issues? And, you know, just from there, we, you know, work with the family, work with all members of the family. Of course, all the family members have to be in agreement to say, okay, we want to make this better. We want it to work, because God knows in many cases they're not interested in cooperating and they each go their own way, and then the business tends to not thrive. So we're very much on top of what families go through. And I did have one member, I love to share this, who said, gosh, if we could only learn to run our businesses with our heads and not our hearts, we'd be a lot more successful. So that's always stayed with me, and it's really the truth.
John Murphy and David Horwich help business owners think like business buyers. Here's some of the common things that they see out there.
We tend to find many of the same things. We look at management. We look at the financial foundation. How good are the numbers, both historically and in the future? We look at the growth. What we often find is business owners spend too much money on growth. They plant a lot of seeds, and they plant too many seeds because they don't take enough time sometimes up front to determine what are the criteria they should use to judge the seeds, so they kind of plant a lot.
Another common theme that's been running through a lot of our clients over the last year or so has been sales operations and sales strategy and sales operations and development. A lot of companies that we've been working with, they're stalled out in growth and they're not sure why. And what we have found in taking a good hard look at them is that they don't have a great sales strategy in place. So we help them assess that, put that in place, and then get it going.
Today's topic is about cost reduction, specifically LED lighting. Here's Chaz Dykes.
LED lights are something in the neighborhood of 70% more efficient. So it's a substantial, very significant savings. Whenever I explain our program of cost reduction through LED retrofit, people say, oh yeah, that's exactly like what they're doing with the solar panels. And I'll tell you what, it's really very, very different than that. What people fail to understand is that if you go with the solar projects for your house and you have the panels put on, you don't own those panels. The company owns those panels, and you're just leasing them.
Oh.
That, the company goes in and goes to the feds and to the local governments and gets
credits.
All of those credits and all those rebates. They do. Under with my program, you own the lights, you get all of that savings in addition to the reduced cost.
Okay, so you're ready to start your exit plan. We asked for three quick tips from Stacy McKibben.
Get your number. What is it that you're retiring to or that you're working towards? Understand what that is. That'll help your team to be able to help you to work backwards from that. So know that number and be prepared. Two is look around at your team. Core values of a company are exuded and exemplified by their team. More often than not, the challenges that I see in profitability are due to the fact of lack of productivity by the team. Lastly is run your business like you drive your car. You look at your car with a dashboard. You would get in a car and you would make sure that you had enough gas, that there was no check engine light on. All of those same things apply in your business. Do you have a clear dashboard? Do you understand how to read it? You don't need to be an accountant, but you do need to understand what the numbers are, and that is the health radiant of a business.
You're listening to one of many shows on ExitCoachRadio.com. We're interviewing advisors, authors, and thought leaders for their best tips, ideas, and precautions so you can be well-planned. If you'd like to be a guest on any of our shows, go to guest.ExitCoachRadio.com. ExitCoachRadio.com. Come listen for a minute.
You're listening to ExitCoachRadio.com, the information station for age 50-plus business owners, where we're interviewing top advisors for their best tips, ideas, and precautions so you can be well-planned. We upload new one-minute tips every day. ExitCoachRadio.com. Come listen for a minute.
Welcome, everyone. Thanks so much for joining me today. Always a pleasure. My next guest, in 12 years of owning multiple small businesses, Sean Adams, my next guest, felt overwhelmingly stress stemming from the government and banks having control over his income. He consumed hundreds of books, interviews, and courses to learn as much as he could about finance and discovered the ultra-rich had insider knowledge about protecting and growing wealth. Sean made it his mission to distill down these secrets and make sure everyone had access to them. This led him to found Leverage Life Management in order to help other professionals leverage a time-tested wealth-building strategy of the ultra-rich. Sean, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Hey, Bill. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure, Sean. Hey, before we get into this very interesting topic, tell us a little bit more about you and your background and what you've been up to for the last many years.
Yeah, well, like you touched on in that intro there, my background stems from the small business world. So I actually had a homegrown home service business. I started as a landscaping company when I was in high school, pushing the lawnmower around the neighborhood, just making a couple extra bucks, and I fell in love with entrepreneurship. I love this idea of autonomy, being able to kind of call my own shots and build something that wasn't there previously. And I just really loved the activities that stemmed from that. And I spent about the first 10 years of my career, 10, 12 years, growing that business. And I learned the hard way what the gaps were, both in my personality and my skill set. I had no, MBA. I had no business experience. I was learning on the job. And there were certainly a lot of mistakes that I made along the way there. The biggest one was really financial literacy. I just didn't understand what it meant to have positive cash flow, to know where to store cash, how to finance things, how things really worked in terms of banking and storage of cash. And it came back and bit me many, many different times and lots of stories to unpack there. But, the main thread was really that I needed to get financially educated so that I could move this business forward and started to, consume content, you mentioned in the bio there, and really fell in love with the idea that this was information that I could put into play right away. There was these strategies that ultra-wealthy people were doing. They were involving things like life insurance and privatized types of accounts that could really move the needle. And they started to help me in a transformational way. And I just really wanted to try to help other people because I found that these secrets were just that. They were not shared publicly. It was not the same information that I got, when I sat at the dinner table with my parents or friends and family. So, that's what brought me into wanting to share these concepts, specifically with business owners who I believe need to hear this most.
Excellent, excellent. So, you've been in business. You realize, there's some secrets out there. There's some things that ultra-rich people know about. And a lot of our listeners are in a position where they run a business, they're doing well for themselves, but someday they may have a lot of cash on hand as they sell their business and liquidate. And so we want to learn as much as we can about you today, about what the strategies are. So tell us how and where the wealthy warehouse their cash to get guaranteed growth on their money. I guess let's jump right into it, Sean.
Sure. Yeah, Bill, so if I can back up one step, I'll take it here. So one of the concepts that I learned really early on for some ultra-wealthy people that I studied and sat and talked with was this idea of leverage. I ended up naming my firm Leveraged Life Management because of this concept. It's the idea that the wealthy look at points where they can apply leverage positively for their own gain, things like compound interest and building things on their own terms. But they also look for opportunities where they are over-leveraged. In other words, where are their positions in their business, outside circumstances, economies, currencies, what have you, where they are out of control and simple shifts could actually take them out of their rhythms and affect their change, basically areas where they don't have full control. And one of them was where they store their cash. And I thought everyone just put all their money in a bank, let it sit there, and they used it when they needed it. And the wealthy people just had a lot more of that dry powder than I did, right? That's what I thought. What I found is that's not where they keep their money. Of course, everybody has money in their checking accounts and maybe some money in, you know, a savings account or something like that. But long-term cash, dry powder that they were using in between investments or after they had liquidated a position, sold a piece of real estate, what have you, they were stored in a lot of different places. But one of the main ones was actually this thing called a cash value life insurance policy. And I learned this because this is exactly what banks do. You know, most people think banks are just this big vault. They store cash in there. Well, what they actually do is they take our cash along with the profits from their other business operations, and they store them in what are called BOLIs, or bank-owned life insurance policies. And the reason the banks do this is because they get a guaranteed rate of return. These whole cash value life insurance policies actually provide a minimum of a 4% guaranteed rate of return on the cash value that's deposited in them. And that is non-correlated. So it's not linked to any stock market. It's kind of like a credit union. They provide you this mm-hmm. rate of return on your money. It's liquid. They can use it on their own terms. And basically, it's a much better warehouse than keeping it in some kind of savings account where you're getting, you know, 0.1% or something abysmal in a regular bank account. And so wealthy people recognize that, why am I storing my money in this bank, which is essentially a third party who's making money on my money? Why don't I cut out the middleman, store my money in these policies, get that guaranteed growth, but also allow me to leverage it? So we're not talking, Bill, about the end investment. You know, 4% is great and everything, but that's not what's going to make us wealthy. What they really wanted is to store their dry powder in this place where they could use it. So 4% now became the minimum growth that they were going to get on their money instead of the maximum.
I see. Okay, so yeah, I'm you're right. There's a category of insurance products called BOLI, but bank-owned life insurance. It's very popular, and there's also a version at the corporate level called COLI, or corporate or company-owned life insurance, where companies store their insurance for post-retirement benefits for their key executives. So, okay, I think we've established that these obviously banks and big companies do a lot of due diligence before they invest in these types of products, right? So decided, hey, let's just do this. They obviously do a lot of due diligence. But there are also, for our listeners probably are wondering, yeah, but aren't there a lot of expenses to life insurance? And what am I what about all the expense of all of that? Doesn't that eat into the yield? And but there's a benefit to paying that expense. Can you tell us what that is?
Absolutely, yeah. So, Bill, most of your audience is aware of what life insurance does. It's just a hedge against your inevitable death, whether that's tomorrow or, you know, 50 years from now. And so you put life insurance in place in case you die prematurely. There's going to be some sort of payout that covers as an umbrella to your friends and loved ones or whoever you deem to receive that benefit, right? Well, most people stop there and go, okay, well, I'm paying into this black hole expense that only helps me if I die prematurely, but it doesn't help me if I live a nice, long, healthy life. I basically just incur this expense. Well, if you set up one of these policies correctly, this is a cash value whole life policy. You can do this personally. You can do it for a small business or any size entity moving forward from there. If you set this up correctly, what ends up happening is you're buying the death benefit, and that's the expense in the beginning, but mm-hmm. you are insuring that one component. So you put dollars into this policy. Yes, it's buying you a death benefit, and that can range from, you know, $20,000 to $20 million and every number in between there, but it also allows you, the cash that you pay in will grow in cash value. So basically like a bank account, right? So most of us know if we were to pay our car insurance every month, $100, we pay $100 in, that money just evaporates. It's like rent. It doesn't have rollover if we don't use it. It's not like, you know, one of the big insurance carriers is not going to, they're going to store our cash for us if we don't get in an accident, right? They don't do that. But in life insurance, they actually do. So a small component of, let's say, the $100 you put in to a policy goes to the coverage, the expense component. But something like 80, 90% of that is going to go into cash value if it's set up properly. That cash value is the amount that gets the 4% compounding rate of return. So, you know, what ultra-wealthy people and big banks and corporations recognized is, okay, I can insure the life of myself, my top executives, employees, partners with that death benefit, but I can also get all these living benefits with this cash value, because if I'm putting money in here, yes, I want that protection, but I also want to make sure I can use that cash, and then the cash that I have available to be used is growing at a compounding rate as well. So if set up properly, and that is a very key word here, because most of them are not set up in the right way, we're able to, you know, do that in a way that helps us to maximize the growth on our money as well as being protected for ourselves and our families.
Yeah, I heard you say that term, if set up properly. So, and you, so you just said that most of them aren't set up properly. So what does that mean to the layperson out there who doesn't have a, you know, a degree in insurance? What does that mean, set up properly versus improperly? How would they know if the, a policy they might have already is set up in this way, or what should they look for, and who should they turn to find one that's set up properly?
Sure, Bill. The analogy I use is, you know, if you were a real estate investor and you were buying into very specific types of properties that had a certain yield and had all of these criteria, and you went into your everyday Joe Schmo agent down the street and said, hey, I need you to help me find this, you know, rare investment property. They're going to think that they know what they're going to do because they have a real estate or a real estate agent on their business card, but that does not qualify them to know how to do the nuances that go into that industry. The exact same thing happens with agents in life insurance, right? That person down the street, 9 times out of 10, they have no idea the limits in which these products can be manipulated and moved. And so what we specialize in, for example, is understanding how big banks, corporations, people like the Rockefellers and these unbelievably large, you know, family offices have been able to really know the rules of the game, know which carriers allow for the most flexibility, and be able to design policies in a way that is advantageous for cash value growth, not just death benefit protection. So the unfortunate reality with, you know, life insurance is one of those things that's kind of taboo. It's like saying you're a used car salesman. Most people back away from you when you say you're in life insurance because you feel like you're going to be sold some level of snake oil. And the reality is the past 60 years, that has been the case, Bill. It's been something that the way that they're structured is to jack up the incentives or the commissions for the agent. And so the base premiums get inflated because the agent is paid on the size of that premium. And what they don't understand is if they actually were to shrink down to the lowest or the minimum, it's much, much more advantageous for the client. It allows them to put a lot more of their own cash in. It performs exponentially better, and it's an overall better living benefit product. But like anything else, you know, agents are incentivized against being in the client's best interest. So, you know, it's important for us to do our due diligence. I look at policies and do audits on them every single week for clients. I very, very rarely, 1% of the time, where someone actually has one that's fully optimized. So it's worth getting a second set of eyes on it, and nothing else, just to understand what you're actually paying for and see what opportunities exist.
Yeah, one telltale sign could be in being able to look at a life insurance proposal or ledger. There's usually some kind of a ledger that comes along with it that shows the money in and the money out and the resulting ending cash value year by year, right, in an illustration. If someone puts in $100,000 and sees zero cash value in the first year, they're probably looking at a policy that was pretty heavily loaded for the agent, right?
That's very, very true. Yeah, that's a really tactical example there. That illustration, like you mentioned, is going to speak volumes to how it was set up. The larger the premium, meaning dollars that go to the insurance company, the less amount of cash value or equity that the client builds in. So that's where I start. I actually look at those illustrations and see, but you're absolutely right. You can tell so much just from that knowledge.
What would you say at a minimum someone should see in that first year per, let's say, 100,000 put in as the ending accumulated value or cash value of a policy to let them know that they've got something that's more, that's going to be more efficient, as you're talking about?
Yeah, generally. If you see anything less, generally speaking, anything less than about 75% of that first year contribution, or really any year contribution, especially the first couple of years, showing up in cash value. If you're put in $100,000 and you're seeing, you know, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 show up, that is a policy that has not been optimized. The average for us is about between 85% and 90% shows up in year one, right? And so that means that only 10 to 15% is going to the expense of the insurance in the first couple of years before the break even happens. The other factor or metric to track is that break even. If you look at traditional whole life, that break even sometimes is in for year 12, year 15 in some cases, or further.
Right.
With ours, we average between, you know, years 2 and 5 to break even, meaning that even the dollars that we put into premium are going to show up in cash value once the account has been sort of paid up in full in that sense.
Very good. And let's talk a little bit about the use of the money once it's in the policy, because there are some very attractive attributes to a life insurance policy that other types of vehicles don't enjoy, including their cousin, the annuities out there. They used to all be the same way back when, but they changed the annuities to where you have to take out the interest first and then you get back to your initial deposits. But with life insurance, you can still take out the money you put in after tax first on a tax-free basis and then get to the gain, or you can borrow, right? Let's talk about that.
That's absolutely right, Bill. And that is one of the major advantages here, especially for business owners. And I know your audience is, you know, typically looking towards retirement in the near future. And so one of the things that is useful with life insurance, it's structured properly, is the loan provision, the ability to loan out, right? So it kind of works like equity inside of a home. So if you had $100,000 in equity inside of your home, we all know we could go down to the bank or a third party and be able to take a loan out against that equity, right? Typically up to 70, 80, 90% of that value. We can tap into it, right? We're not really removing it, but we're just loaning out against it. That means that the whole property itself, though, continues to go up in value regardless of how much equity we have in the property, right? Same thing happens with a policy. If we had $100,000 in cash value growing at 4% every single year, it's appreciating, and we wanted to use $50,000 to buy a vacation home or buy a property or whatever we want to do, there's really no limits. Instead of withdrawing $50,000 from a big pot of money that's compounding, right? One of the worst things you can do is take a withdrawal, because now the $50,000 is compounding instead of the $100,000. So you can actually use that $100,000 as basically an equity position, and you can loan out against it using the cash value as collateral. The insurance company will loan you up to the cash value amount you have in there, and you can use that loan for whatever that you want. You actually have full control over the payback terms if you want to pay them back at all, because the insurance company knows you're good for it. Because essentially, at the end of the day, whenever you pass away, they have to pay you out that death benefit. So whatever you owe them from the loan, they will take out of that death benefit. And the real secret sauce of all this is, if I had $100,000, I took a loan out for $50,000, the entire $100,000 that I had in my policy continues to get that 4% or 6% compounding growth as if I never took out that loan. So you can start to see, for business owners, how we can start to kind of build our own little private banking system by putting cash in here first, leveraging it through the use of a loan, and being able to actually double dip our money. There's a small percentage of interest that we're charged for borrowing that money, but if done properly, you're always going to have a positive arbitrage between those two figures.
Very nice, very nice. So very well explained, Sean. You really helped our listeners. What else should they know as far as quality of carrier, issues like that? Because I think a lot of people are, you know, nervous about putting too much into a bank, but how about the quality of a life insurance carrier and how they're regulated, that kind of thing, just in a minute or so, if you could.
Absolutely, yeah. So the carriers that we work with, they are all, our record is 100-plus years of consecutive growth or consecutive returns of premium, returns of dividends. And so we work with the top four carriers among some smaller ones as well. But we use historical data as our guidepost. So they need to be a business for at least 100 years. They need to have always returned that minimum of the floor, in this case 4%, for us to make sure that they're a quality carrier. So these are all AA rated companies. We always share all the information with them. But just like anything else, Bill, you need to be able to do your due diligence. Not all carriers are created equally, just like not all agents are created equally. And so it's well worth doing your research there. But yes, absolutely. The companies that can really benefit and know how you can leverage them. It's really important to know the rules that are at play, because just because this concept is possible doesn't mean that every carrier does it the same way. So it's important to have an advisor kind of walk you through what's possible based on your scenario, your age, funding limits, state that you live in, all those sort of things.
Excellent job, Sean, explaining something that is, sometimes thought of as a mundane, unexciting type of a product, but it really is, like you said, it's what banks use, it's what big corporations use and successful people use as a leverage technique to grow money, put money into play, and also to use it to borrow back out and take advantage of other opportunities. How do our listeners best get in touch with you?
Yeah, best thing to do, Bill, we focus on education first. So if you go to my website, leveraged-life.com, leveraged-life.com, I've got an entire video series. It's all free. You don't even have to put an email in. I've got blog posts. I have my own podcast called Wealth Secrets. And all we do is just distill down these concepts. We show you actual illustrations. We walk through it. This is bland, boring stuff for most people. We try to make it in a couple of minute videos so people can understand it. And if you see that maybe your policy is not optimized or you want to learn more about how to take advantage of that, there's all kinds of areas where you can actually book a free complimentary call. I'll do a free audit on your policy as well as make some suggestions for you. So you can find all that on the website.
Great. Again, that's leveragedlife.com. Sean Adams, thanks so much for joining me today. It's been a real pleasure, and you really helped our listeners understand something better than we've ever heard before. So really appreciate your time today.
Thanks so much, Bill. It's great to be here.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back after this, so please stay with us.
You're listening to one of many shows on ExitCoachRadio.com. We're interviewing advisors, authors, and thought leaders for their best tips, ideas, and precautions so you can be well-planned. If you'd like to be a guest on any of our shows, go to guest.exitcoachradio.com. ExitCoachRadio.com. Come listen for a minute.
Listening to ExitCoachRadio.com, the information station for age 50-plus business owners, where we're interviewing top advisors for their best tips, ideas, and precautions so you can be well-planned. We upload new one-minute tips every day. ExitCoachRadio.com. Come listen for a minute.